Today is October 14th, 2015, and this is episode number 328 of the Apple Context Machine, a podcast for the Mac Observer. I'm Jeff Gamet, managing editor at TMO.
And I'm Brian Chaffin, just a jade plant on a table yearning for some sun. To get the full story on anything we cover in this podcast, you can visit macobserver.com/ACM. And if you'd like to comment on or question anything about the show, shoot us a note at acm@macobserver.com.
Just a jade plant yearning for some sun.
There's a
song in there, Brian.
There's a song, yeah. I like it.
Yeah.
I like it. You know what else I like?
Really good drinks at your favorite coffee shop.
Yes.
Red velvet cake.
Yeah, yes.
Tiramisu? All right. Let's see. Oh, coffee drinks that have that fake kind of Bailey's.
Yes, Irish cream.
Irish cream.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yep, and as well, I like my DSLR.
Oh, that's so funny. I was going around things that taste good, and you're thinking about cameras.
I was thinking about cameras, yeah.
Huh. You know, you're actually a really good photographer. I totally get why you would enjoy your DSLR.
I do enjoy a DSLR.
Now, in contrast, while I would love to have a DSLR, I just keep using my iPhone for all my photographs.
Yeah, it's hard for me to bother taking my DSLR anymore. The iPhone has become so good at taking photographs.
Yeah, and now that we have the new camera, the 12-megapixel camera in the iPhone 6S series, man, it's crazy. Oh, here's an example that kind of blew my socks off earlier today. But while I was doing my daily walk over to get my iSoy chai that I know you love.
Chalk. Yeah. It's just chalk. Like, just take a little Phillips milk of magnesia, dilute it with some water, and call it a day, man.
Now, see, when you put it that way, it doesn't sound like it tastes that good.
It exactly. But that's my point.
Now, see, it tastes good. See, when you're using soy instead of milk, you're not masking as many of the spices that are in the chai, so you get this richer, fuller flavor. Also, dairy allergy, so there's that.
There is that, yeah.
Yeah. So regardless of whether or not you think I should use milk in my drinks, I get off on a technicality. Anyhow, the point is, my route that I take to the coffee shop gives me the opportunity to take some fun photos along the way. Today, I did a pano shot. And when I looked at the image when I got back to my desk on my big screen, I was picking up birds in the photo flying around that I didn't see in the air when I actually took the shot. That's pretty cool.
That is cool. That is cool. But, you know, there's something. The iPhone takes amazing photographs. This is just, it's absolutely true. But there's a level of control that you get with a DSLR.
Oh, yeah, that's true.
And there's, of course, control over your depth of field.
Right. Yeah, you can swap out lenses. You can manage your f-stop. And do you like how I tossed out a camera word?
Yeah, I like that. That was nice.
Thanks. Yeah.
Yeah. There's a lot that you can control with the DSLR, but here's a true story for you. The thing I like most about a DSLR is framing the image by holding up the camera to my head and blocking out everything else.
Yeah.
And that is something that you don't get. You know, it's interesting. You watch people take a photograph with an iPhone or, you know, any smartphone, but let's just be honest, you know, most digital photography at this point is being done with iPhones. Most mobile phone photography is being done with iPhones. And you watch people take the shot, and you know, they hold up their camera and they shoot, and people shoot a lot more quickly with an iPhone than they do if they were using something that they're holding up to their head. And I think that part of that is that when you're blocking out all of the rest of the world except for what you're seeing through the camera, your mind focuses on what's in that frame more than when you're just holding something up and you still see the rest of the world. You know what I'm saying? Am I being clear here?
Yes. Yeah, I get what you're saying. And okay, so to kind of build on that some, one thing that I noticed, and this is something I noticed even before we were using our smartphones as our primary cameras, and I was carrying a digital point and shoot a lot. There's so much that you can do with the DSLR that on one hand is awesome, because you can do like you said, you can block out the rest of the world when you go to take a shot, and you have this incredible control of depth of field and your exposure and everything else, and that's great, and it has afforded people the ability to come up with incredibly beautiful and creative photos. The other side of that, though, is that there's a lot of photos that people miss because they are so busy fiddling with their DSLR that they don't get the shot. And I would pull up my little point and shoot, take a photo, and move on to the next thing. And I have friends that are really into their DSLRs who would get upset when they saw the photo that I had taken with a little point and shoot. And then they looked at what they had on their digital camera or on their DSLR. Mine was better. Not because I had all this control over all the settings, but because I had the freedom to just look at what I wanted to shoot and then take the shot at the right moment.
Well, you know, that is certainly a good point, and that is something that the iPhone has an even more distinct advantage over.
Oh, yes.
The point and shoots. And I'll throw in the fact that all of those things that you have control over also makes a DSLR far harder to master.
Oh, yeah, of course.
You know, you generally speaking, any numbnut with an iPhone can take a good photograph.
Generally speaking.
I mean, you still need to know what to point at. And you still need to know when to pull when to snap the shutter and when not to snap the shutter. But other than that, taking a good photograph with an iPhone is much easier than it's ever been.
Yes. Yes, it is.
And which is a good thing. I'm not decrying the rise of the iPhone. If anything, the bar has been lifted on what makes a good photograph. The bar has been like propelled skyward on a rocket.
Right. Yeah, there are photos that I can take with my iPhone that I never would have imagined being able to capture before. And in some cases, people look at them and they're really impressed with the shots that I get. And maybe I could have gotten those with a DSLR, but I think part of what lets me get the shots that I get that actually do turn out really well is the fact that I have the freedom to just pull a phone out of my pocket and take the shot and not worry about anything else.
Yeah. And you know, not lugging around a camera. And, yeah. You know, like I'm not a big fan of zoom lenses on a DSLR. There are certainly some great zoom lenses out there, but you know, for taking portraits, I've my Nikkor 1.4, f-stop 85 millimeter lens. You know, no zoom lens is going to touch that thing.
Mm-hmm.
You know, but the reality is that now if I want to actually shoot, because I'm this like zoom lens snob, now I've got to have a minimum of two, probably three or four lenses with me. And that's, you know, that means that
that planning anything with the DSLR actually requires planning.
Yeah, using a DSLR is a commitment.
Yeah, it's a commitment, right. And so it's interesting then to see what this company called Light is doing.
Ah, the L16.
Yeah, you wrote about that. Why don't you tell us about it?
All right, so the L16 is a digital camera that's about the size of a smartphone. And what makes this different from other digital cameras is that it has 16 different cameras built into it. And so what it does is it uses the different cameras in tandem to take a photograph. So you get a pretty incredible depth of field. And then you get multiple sets of data to stitch the image, the final image, together with. And then it has its own software built into the camera, so it actually does that. So you can have images that are up to 52 megapixels coming off of this thing. And the image quality is really impressive. And when you're looking at this thing, it's just as simple as pulling your iPhone out of your pocket and taking a photo. And yet...
Well, and I believe that their business model is actually to eventually sell this to camera makers. To smartphone makers. So this is theoretically something that could be built into an Android device or an iPhone. If Apple is probably, unless Apple buys the company, Apple's not going to license the technology.
Right. And it doesn't need to be 16 cameras. It just so happens that's what they're using in the L16.
You know what I'd like, by the way, is I'd like one of these built in as a case for an iPhone.
That would be pretty cool.
That would be a lot more palatable to me than going back to carrying another device.
Yeah. I would like that. That would be kind of cool. I mean, the way it's designed right now, and just so everyone knows, what we have seen today is a prototype. It's not actually shipping until next year. But they're equating it to what you would get if you drop $6,000 on a DSLR, and they're going to sell this thing for $1,200. Does that sound right?
I thought it was more like 15. I don't know. Something over a grand. Yeah, 1,200 is what you wrote. You must be right.
Okay, well, there you go. So that's kind of cool, because if you can get the same quality that you would otherwise need to spend $6,000 for, and it's in something that fits in your pocket just like a smartphone does, that's kind of cool and that's kind of interesting, and it shows where the digital camera technology is going.
Yeah, and we should probably explain some of this. So it has five 35 millimeter lenses,
mm-hmm.
Five 70 millimeter lenses, and then 650 millimeter lenses. And what it's doing is they're actually saving the difference between images,
which is really interesting.
Yeah, that's because that saves on space.
Yeah, and then it puts
storage space,
right? And so then it puts all of the pieces together that it has to give you a completed image, and you're not going to see like stitch lines or anything like that, because it's really good at blending all the images together into one single composite.
And what it means is you have an actual optical zoom, right? It's not a digital zoom.
Right. And for people that don't get the difference, optical zoom means you have lenses where you're changing that focal length, so you zoom in. Whereas a digital zoom, what you're doing is you're taking the pixels you already have and kind of blowing them up and cropping out the rest of the image.
Yeah.
So you're not actually getting a close-up. You're just blowing up what you already have. And ultimately, you end up with a lower quality image. Even if you may not be able to see it, it's still a lower quality image.
Yeah, optical zoom is infinitely preferable to digital zoom when it comes to image quality.
Right, because one is actually zooming and the other is not.
Right. So, I mean, this is... They had a bold prediction interview that we read today. Let's stick a link up to that interview where they were predicting that DSLRs would be, you know, gone by 2025. And I mean that's not going to happen.
No, it's not.
I mean, I think that DSLRs will be completely supplanted by all but some niche uses, and you know, in the 2025 version of the hipster.
No, the focal length of an actual lens, man, is just so much better.
Which may actually still even be true at that point, but DSLRs are just going to be replaced by smartphones and whatever. Well, you know, what's actually going to happen though? Smartphones will be replaced with something else within that time frame too. You know, we will be using a different paradigm for communications by 2025.
Yeah, so 10 years from now. The form factor of a smartphone as we know it today will not be the same as it is 10 years from now. I mean, look at where we were 10 years ago with smartphones. Well, with phones, smartphones weren't nearly the thing that they are now. And the form factor's changed a lot. So to assume that the form factor of our phones will be the same 10 years from now, I think is kind of myopic. So that could mean that we need to have a dedicated camera again.
Well, which is the interesting thing. It could turn out that cameras are the thing that actually keeps smartphones being a thing. People might not be willing to give up the ability to film and photograph their lives and themselves.
Oh, they're not going to want to give that up. So there has to be a platform that makes it easy and convenient and gives people the level of quality they expect from the videos and photographs that they're capturing.
Yeah.
So, sure, I could see where we could end up with the smartphone form factors staying similar, but on the other hand, we could end up with something totally different, just to accommodate the phone.
Right, we could. Yeah, it's gonna be interesting. But I think that this technology that light is developing, this notion of using multiple digital camera units. I don't know exactly how to express it.
Camera elements.
There we go. Multiple camera elements to allow for a greater variety of shots. I mean, that's going to be a thing for sure.
Yeah,
and it's going to be the kind of thing that definitely eats into DSLR land. And all the while, I'll still wish that I could hold up the camera.
Well, you know, maybe this is the real reason why iPads have cameras. So we can put a big slab in front of our face and not see anything else.
Yeah, it's still not the same to me. And I don't know how much of that is just because I grew up sticking a camera up to my face. But I really think that there's something to be said for blocking out the rest of the world, for only seeing what the photograph sees and blocking out everything else. I think that there is a zen-like quality to that, or something that offers greater potential for a great photograph.
Yeah, I can see that. And it's things like this that have me yearn to get a digital camera. Or a DSLR, and I periodically look online for used DSLRs to see if I can find something I like that falls in a price range I'm willing to go for. And occasionally I do find something, and then I don't buy it.
Yeah, that's interesting. I wonder what our listeners do. Do we have any listeners who are using or not using DSLRs?
I'm certain we do.
Yeah. Well, let us know.
Yeah, I would love to hear your take on the whole DSLR thing.
So would I. Yeah, always interested in what our listeners have to say. That's a good time.
Yeah, we have some smart people listening to the show.
Yes, we do. We actually have some really smart people listening to the show. It's one of the awesome things about what we get to do here.
Totally true. And what I'm hoping is that right now every single listener has a warm feeling in their heart because they're like, yeah, I really am smart.
Well, we did, we got some letters. Should we take a look at them?
Oh, let's take a look at letters, please.
So now we didn't actually do any homework here.
We did perfect. That makes this more natural. It makes us seem more human to our listeners.
We didn't actually look and see what people said. So I'm going to start reading. I have no idea what I'm reading.
This is going to be the best ever.
Yeah. All right. So Mathis Drolet.
We're off to a great start.
He wrote and said, hey, guys, writing to you here from the middle of the Senegalese jungle. Wow. That's
awesome.
Way cool. And still keeping up with ACM mostly. Man, dude.
That's awesome. Dedication.
That is
right
thank,
there.
Thank you so much. Anyway, he's doing so through a satellite dish since I've been here the last 2 years. This is the first time I've written. Thanks, man. Proactive versus now, he's referring to Google now, is definitely for me the only real upside to Android that Apple seems to be constantly playing catch up on. Internet service is an issue in general, but that isn't specific to iOS. He has a point. Right. So caveat, I will be getting my very first iPhone, the 6S, next year, and I have only a non-Google Now capable Android phone. He said, yeah, but it was cheap. Fair enough, man. During your discussion on the differences between Apple and Android on this, I started thinking about the possibility for Apple to save our personal information online via the iCloud account. I was wondering if this could help Apple increase the use of Proactive Siri, especially if Apple focuses on analyzing the proactive data only on the device. Here would be my concept of how this would work. After opting in, when you set up your new iPhone, Apple will make your information from Mail, Calendar, Safari, interactions with Siri, and maybe even specific information from apps available to Siri and Spotlight across all your devices. But the data would be encrypted with the maximum encryption the iPhone can efficiently use right on the device before going out to iCloud, and would be decrypted through your login of the devices. Finally, if you opt out, all data from that device or devices would be erased permanently. So he basically says that he thinks that would be a good balance between security and privacy.
That would be kind of an interesting way to do it.
Well, it would be, but... Oh, and he... Look at this. At the very end, he gives us pronunciation advice on his name. It's Matisse, of course.
Yeah, common spelling.
Yeah, common. So I'm sorry for being a doofus. Like I said, no homework. Didn't actually read that ahead of time. So Matisse, thank you first of all for the letter. The problem is philosophical here. Apple is saying it doesn't have your data, and that your data is not going to the cloud. So yeah, Apple scooping up all of your information, sending it to the cloud for processing, but not using it for anything else, and keeping it somehow...
Well, okay. Now, the way he's describing it is the processing is handled by our local devices, and the cloud, I think, is being used only as an encrypted storage place.
I took it as it was being collected locally, but being... processed on the cloud. I thought that the idea there was to offload the heavy data crunching.
I like my interpretation.
Well, either way, it's. I mean, Either way, it is at odds with what Apple is saying right now. Apple is saying right now that we're not sending your data to the cloud, that we don't have access to it. And you can't send that information to the cloud and do anything with it and have that be true.
I think that the bigger thing here would be, if Apple has data, regardless of whether or not any of it is processed on their end, at some point, this becomes a liability for them.
Yeah, at some point, it becomes a liability to hackers and or government requests.
Right.
So, in addition, there's an even bigger problem. The big advantage that Google has is not just the fact that Google is processing, you know, information from all of its users, including the information it gets from iOS users on the cloud. It's that it actually has all that data to work together, right? So Google isn't keeping our stuff separate. It's mixing it all in. Some of it theoretically is anonymized.
Right, but they're mixing together our data with other people's data to improve the Google Now service overall.
Yeah, looking for patterns and looking for the ways that we do things so that they can then do something back for us. And so Apple taking our data, putting it to iCloud, processing it, and then sending it back and keeping it all separate doesn't actually do a whole lot to close that gap, except for the fact that it can have servers doing some of the processing instead of our phones. And that's not going to narrow the gap here that Google has, the performance edge that Google has with Google Now versus Apple's Proactive.
Yeah, unless Apple can come up with something that no one has conceived of yet, at least openly, that allows them to do everything that Google is doing with Now, but keep it localized, then there's no way for Apple to truly catch up with what Google's doing in this space. And even then they couldn't, because Google has the advantage of being able to pool everyone's data to look for those patterns that you're just talking about.
Yeah. Yeah, and that, of course, still doesn't touch the benefit that Google has with search. There's so much to be gathered about what people do based on searching and what they actually click on.
That's true.
Especially
Apple doesn't want to know stuff about us like that.
Right. And that was the point of our discussion. So, I still don't know where Apple is going to, how Apple is ever going to be able to narrow this gap with Google Now. I think that Google Now is going to remain a better service than Proactive/Siri.
I think so too. I would love for Apple to come up with a clever way to work around that. But at least today, I don't see any way Apple could do that. So I'll just have to keep hoping for the future.
I know that Apple will find ways to improve Proactive. It's not an issue of whether or not Apple can make Siri and Proactive better, because Apple will make both of those services better.
Mm-hmm.
The thing that both of us are pessimistic about, and pessimistic is probably too weak a word, is Apple being able to close the gap, let alone be better than Google Now.
Yeah.
Brad Hurley wrote and said, it would be interesting and quite useful to hear from listeners about the problems that seem to never get fixed. As an example, in iOS iTunes, there's always been a frustrating issue with the computer authorization feature. It's the one when we are told that the computer isn't authorized. Then, after authorizing, we are told it already is. I would even go beyond calling this merely confusing. This is fundamentally a bug that is well known and as such shouldn't be tolerated or left untended to.
That really annoys me. The problem, not the comment.
Yeah, there are right. Of course,
just to be clear,
there are Apple. I mean, there have been lots of grumblings from Apple fans, especially those who've been around for a long time, that Apple is letting a lot of little things slip through the cracks.
And when some of these things are pointed out, Apple doesn't pick them up and fix them.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, very frustrating.
I had one problem fixed. In iOS 8, I constantly had to sign into Game Center. Of course, I could have just turned off Game Center, but apparently that's not how I roll. So I would have there was a particular guy, Kingdom Rush Frontiers.
Okay.
Kingdom Rush, one of my favorite game franchises on my iPad. I play it a lot. It's a tower defense game. And they've had several iterations. The current one is Kingdom Rush Frontiers, Kingdom Rush Origins is what it's called. And I would be asked to log into Game Center like, you know, 2-3 times a week.
Yeah, that's frustrating. I've had that problem, not to the extent that you have, but that may be because I don't play games to the on the same level that you do.
What are you saying?
Well, what I'm saying is that did you do something with your hair? You look really nice today, Brian.
But that problem went away for me in iOS 9. I haven't had to log into Game Center once.
Okay, well, that's awesome.
Well, except for the, you know.
Except for the first time.
Except for the first time, yeah, when I first set it up. But that's obviously different.
Right, right. Now, really, your hair does look nice.
Okay. So, thank you. So, there are, yeah. So, I don't. What do other listeners, what do our listeners think about this? Do you have some problem that you've noticed? It just doesn't get fixed.
I found a new problem in iOS 9.
Do tell.
All right. So I get the occasional spam call to my phone. Several days ago, I got a phone call from a phishing scammer that was telling me that computers in my area have been targeted by hackers. So they were going to help me fix mine. And so I go into my call history list and I delete those out because I don't need them there. They're coming back and they're showing as missed calls that I haven't. You know when you miss a call and you haven't looked at your missed call list, and so you get the little dots by them and it shows as X number of phone calls missed. They come back. And they show as not having been checked yet. And so I can have no calls showing as missed. And then several hours later, no calls have come in. All of a sudden, I'll have three.
I have not noticed that.
It's really weird. And it's not consistent, but it's very annoying. Mm. I have deleted the same spammer call from my iPhone like two or three times, and I've had several other calls where that's happened too. Very weird.
That is weird. Has anyone else seen that?
Yeah, let me know.
ACM@MacObserver.com. Now we have one more letter that I wanted to get to. This is from Marcel Morend. Now he wrote to us a couple of weeks ago, and I was, if you remember, listeners, this is just between me and Jeff. If you remember, I wrote him and asked for clarification.
Yes, right. Yes, I do.
All right, so now let's bring the listeners back in.
Okay, hey guys, glad you're here. We're so coming straight from the satellites to you.
He was asking if it would be fair if Google were to block me, and that's when I asked him for clarification. This is referring to me being, this is me and Adam in particular, but you and I have talked about this as well many times about how stealing, blocking ads is stealing content, right?
Mm-hmm.
And so I asked him for clarification, and this was his clarification. He said, thanks for the interest in my comment. Sorry for the rather blunt and awkward analogy. I was a little frustrated by your opinion of content blockers. In retrospect, my point might make sense, so let me try and explain it. Memory serves, basically, you said that if you use content blockers, you were stealing content. He's referring to ad blockers in particular. I think the rise in content blocking is because of the increase in horrible ads that publishers have to accept to chase clicks and stay alive. There is a lot of crap content staying alive because of this. My point about Google blocking you comes from the same idea about stealing. I've listened to your podcast for a couple of years now, and it's fairly clear you are not keen on how they collect data. The thing is, it seems to me, the quality of Google search is because of that data. If you aren't willing to share data when you use Google, isn't that stealing as well? I hope that makes sense. And he loves the Mac Observer, which is great. So this is a great opportunity to make, to actually make my point.
Do tell.
I don't block Google. I don't use a lot of their services. But the reason why I don't use their services, a lot of the services, I do use some, is because I am not willing to pay the price of having me become more of the product by using those services. Right? So I don't somehow block Google from getting my stuff because I don't like the price. Instead, I don't use the services. And that is the cornerstone of my belief on blocking ads or pirating music or pirating TV shows. If you don't like the price, you don't get you're not entitled to consume the content anyway. You are entitled to not consume the content, to boycott the service, to boycott the data, to boycott the music, to boycott the TV show because you think it's too expensive or because you don't like the ads. That is my point.
Boycotting is different from blocking. Yep.
If you don't like the price, don't get the stuff. For me, I don't like Google's price. And now there are some things. Here's the funny thing about Google and search. I'm fine with Google using my search information to make search better. That actually makes a lot of sense to me, and I'm fine with it. And I understand that I'm going to be the product there, and I have chosen to accept that price and to use Google search. And I do, by the way, I use Google search.
If you weren't comfortable with that, would you switch and use, say, like DuckDuckGo?
Yes. And I probably should use DuckDuckGo anyway. DuckDuckGo is a search engine that specifically issues making us the product.
Right.
And so I do not advocate blocking Google somehow from getting my information. I don't advocate that at all. That's their price. Their price for all these free services is that we be the product. I don't advocate that at all. Can't. Okay. Not that you could do it anyway. But the only way you can do it is to not use the service. I'm not going to be an Android user. I'm not going to be a Chromebook user. I'm not a Chrome user. I will be, however, when Google Fiber comes to my area, I will get that in a heartbeat.
You know, that's kind of funny you would say that because
go ahead. I'm sorry.
Okay. So the deal is I'm in the same boat. When Google Fiber is available in Boulder, I'm sure it will cost substantially less than what I'm paying for my Comcast 100 megabit connection right now.
And be better.
Yeah, and it'll be better. And I'll jump on it. But I also know that Google can now monitor every single thing I do online. Yeah. And they're going to.
And I will do that too because as much as I don't want to become more of the product, I am willing to pay that price for their internet service. I've used Google Fiber at Starbucks. And mm-hmm. When I first realized how awesome it was is when I had a software update. Now, if you've ever done a software update, if you've ever been foolish enough to start a software update in a Starbucks, you know.
No, I've never, ever done that.
You know, I mean, it's hard enough to watch a video in most Starbucks because everybody else is doing the same thing.
Right.
Right. And I accidentally, I just sort of knee-jerk clicked install. And it was like, in the time it took me to panic, the download had finished in a Starbucks.
That's really impressive. That's really cool.
Yeah, it's like, okay, I I will pay their price of becoming more of the product to get that kind of service.
Yeah, everyone has a price, and we know what our price is. It's crazy fast fiber.
Yeah, apparently. Internet. Apparently. And yeah. And yeah, even though I know that now, like, every bloody web page that I go to, every little thing that I do is going to be further added to my profile.
Yeah. And yet here I am thinking the same things and just counting the days. And I'm assuming that this is something that I may be able to get on board with in the next couple years, because Google is building a really big campus in Boulder.
They've
already broken ground, and they've had some a bunch of offices here for a while, but now they're putting a big campus here. And the Starbucks that's only a couple blocks from me has Google Fiber.
All right, so Marcel, please let me know if you still think that I'm being inconsistent. I think that I'm actually quite consistent on this. Definitely write and let us know what you think.
Yeah, and thanks for the letters, because that's so awesome.
Yeah, we appreciate the letters, folks. Write us acm@macobserver.com. We want to hear from you. You can tweet us. I'm TM O'Brien. That's Brian with a Y on the Twitters.
Uh-huh. And I'm Jay Gamut with a J.
Yeah, on the Twitters.
And we'll beam answers back to you from our satellites orbiting in space.
Yes, exactly. Exactly. That is precisely what we'll do. Okay, let's move on to something that we were quite surprised that someone was going to do. That's just an awkward.
That's the worst lead in to a legal discussion I've heard in like the last 20 minutes.
Right. So the DOJ pulled. The DOJ recommended that Michael Bromwich be pulled as Apple's court-appointed monitor.
Right. And the backstory is Apple and five of the big publishers were all accused of conspiring to artificially raise the price of ebooks. The DOJ took them to court over this. The publishers all did deals so they wouldn't have to go to court, because they were afraid that if they lost, it would drive them out of business. Apple stuck to their guns and said, we never did anything wrong. And then Judge Denise Coate ruled that Apple, in fact, had. And part of her sentencing included placing a court-appointed monitor inside Apple to make sure that Apple did not engage in antitrust activities, and that Apple put in place special training to ensure that employees knew how to avoid getting themselves into an antitrust activity.
Something that Apple resisted the entire time.
Yes, and it was unprecedented, because putting a court-appointed monitor into a business is something that's done when you have a long and protracted history of whatever the violation is. Apple did not, and the company agrees to the monitor.
Yeah, it's usually part of a you know, settlement.
Right. And Apple did not agree. And Apple is at the point now where their next step would be appealing to the United States Supreme Court. And I'm sure that they're mulling over what to do even as we speak.
Right. So Apple lost an appeal, which, you know, so you and I were both surprised that Apple lost the case in the first place.
We were not alone. A lot of people were surprised.
And we, you know, of course, we aren't attorneys. Have you played a paralegal? I know that
I've played an attorney.
You played an attorney? Okay. Oh, yeah. I've never even played a paralegal or, say, a secretary at a law office.
Right, but you know me, and that's like,
oh, that's close enough. So I'm as good enough as an attorney.
Right.
Following the evidence and testimony, which we did closely, we knew that Apple was going to win.
Yeah, we followed this so closely, it was probably unhealthy.
Probably. And yet, Apple was found guilty, to our surprise. We also thought that Apple would win on appeal.
They did not.
They did not.
Although the panel was torn.
The panel was torn. That's true. It was obviously the majority upheld the conviction, but the... there was a dissenting judge. I guess Apple could still ask that it be held by the full panel, full court instead of just a 3-judge panel? I think it was 2-1.
Yes. Yeah, I believe they could do that now.
And or just appeal straight to the Supreme Court. We don't know if they're going to one way or the other. They resisted having this court-appointed monitor. They complained about his fees. The guy didn't actually have any specific antitrust experience, so...
And he was demanding unsupervised or unmonitored interviews with Apple executives that in many cases were not involved with negotiations with other companies.
Yeah, it really seemed like he was turning into this. It seemed like he was this investigative arm.
Yes. Yeah, he was acting as an investigative agent of the court.
For the court, which is... The courts aren't supposed to have investigative agents.
Not like this.
No, courts aren't supposed to have... The judge is not supposed to have an investigator. Right? The court does not get an investigator. The investigators come from the plaintiffs, part of the checks and balance of the whole system.
Right. Yeah. And the investigation part that the court would have would actually be coming from law enforcement agencies.
Right. Right. Law enforcement and the courts are closer to being on the same side than not. But investigators generally work for the law enforcement, which in this case would be the DOJ, and not for the. And so it was just this really weird thing. But the appeals court also rejected Apple's call to have the court-appointed monitor dismissed. I mean, Apple's lost at every stage of this. I mean, the appeals court did define and limit his role about, was it 6 months ago, 8 months ago?
Yeah, something like that.
They also said that he was like way out of line with some of the stuff he was doing, which is why they put in those limitations and definitions.
Which is good. They should have been there from the beginning.
They should have. But they didn't dismiss him. And now here it is. It's 2 years later. And we really haven't had a lot of news coming. Like, you know, I guess it's possible that Apple decided to suck it up and play ball and just get through it.
Okay, well, what we do know, and some of this comes from the DOJ letter to Judge Cote, suggesting that that Michael Bromwich's position not be extended.
Which, by the way, it was originally set for 2 years with mm-hmm. an option to extend.
Right.
Right.
And the DOJ is saying, yeah, don't extend it.
Right.
And so what they said was that Apple had done a lot to comply with Judge Cote's demands. And demands isn't the right word.
Orders. Because,
yeah, with her orders. And that even though the relationship that Apple had with Michael Bromwich wasn't exactly healthy, that Apple had been living up to the sentencing that had been given. Apple was doing what they needed to do to comply with Judge Cote's orders. And so the DOJ said, yeah, we don't need to have a court monitor in there anymore.
Which is interesting.
Yes. But to me, more interesting was that a day later, Judge Cote says, yeah, okay, sounds good to me.
Yeah, which, I mean, she basically expressed... She'd always made it clear that Apple was out of its mind on this particular case, that Apple was just wrong, that, you know, that Apple's actions were illegal, that Apple wasn't owning up to the fact that there was a problem. She always made it clear that Apple was in the wrong. And so it's interesting that just boom. All right. See ya. Done.
Yeah, I found that surprising. Now, I was putting odds, if I were a betting man, on a 50-50 chance that she would go with the DOJ's recommendation. And the reason I was that uncertain that she would go that route was because every step along the way in this whole case, she has taken actions that we all thought was really surprising.
Yeah. Yeah, that's right. I just flatly expected her not to do what the DOJ was recommending.
Yeah, and then she was like, yeah, okay, no problem. So that was really surprising. Now, there are probably some people that have had more time practicing law than I have that are sitting back and they're like, oh, you silly little boy. You're so wrong about this. And if so, let me know, because I would love to be enlightened, because everything that I have seen through this whole case has left me stymied. I still don't get why Judge Coate was compelled to rule in favor of the DOJ and against Apple.
Yeah, it doesn't make sense. All right, let's move on to another topic, though.
Okay.
Because we have less than 10 minutes.
Okay. Do you need to vent any frustrations, anything like that?
Well, maybe. So Apple released new iMacs.
Yeah.
And
they're nice.
They're quite nice. I want one. I want a 5K iMac on my desk to replace my 2008 Mac Pro very, very much.
I think that would be a beautiful thing for your desk.
It would be a beautiful thing for my desk. And, you know, so Apple, see, they brought 4K displays down to the 21-inch form factor, 21.5-inch form factor.
Uh-huh.
But there's still some non-Retina displays, right? Non-4K displays.
Yeah, so for $1099, you can get a 21.5-inch iMac with a non-Retina display and a 5,400 RPM hard drive.
Which is slow.
Also, the 21.5-inch models, you have to choose whether you want 8 or 16 gigs of RAM when you buy it, because you cannot upgrade the RAM later.
And that's on the smaller form factor.
Right. On the 27-inch models, user upgradable RAM.
Which is good.
Yes, very good.
User or like authorized dealer?
Upgradable. User.
User upgradable.
User upgradable.
Oh, nice.
Mm-hmm.
That's good. That's good, because Apple wants an arm and a leg for their RAM. Like $900, they want $900 to take you from 16 gigs to 32 gigs. Is that right? Am I getting that right?
I thought there was more that came along with that, but it's too much money.
Let's look.
That is crazy.
I know, it's crazy. By the way, I'm not too keen on the store going away. We haven't really talked about that. The store went away a long time ago. I'm not too keen on it.
It's, you know, I used Apple's website as two independent things, a store and a research tool.
Yeah.
And having it blended together for me hasn't been a huge deal in that I've been using their website primarily as a research tool. And when I need to buy something online, I just go to the Apple Store app on my iPhone and purchase it there.
Okay, that makes sense. What I don't like, the thing I just that was hammering me in the face just now was so to go buy an iMac, or in this case, just do some research on prices, you have to go to apple.com/iMac, or, you know, obviously you could click on Mac by going to apple.com. At the top of the page, there's 21.5-inch and 21.5-inch. You actually have to scroll down below the fold to get to the 27-inch models. So if you don't know that they're there...
You wouldn't know they're there.
You might not know that they're there. So anyway, that's... I'm not...
You know, if you had a 5K display, you'd be able to see below that fold.
That's true. All right, so I lied to you. To go from 8 gigs to 32 gigs is $600.
Okay, that seems a little steep.
Yeah,
still.
It's still steep. To go from 8 to 16 gigs is $200. What do they want? They want $900 for a terabyte of flash storage in lieu of the terabyte Fusion drive. This is for the 27-inch. I just clicked on the middle configuration, and then I'm looking at the upgrade prices there.
Okay.
And $600. I don't know. That seems a lot for the RAM. It seems like an awful lot for the RAM. So I'm glad the users can do that. Although I'm going to bet that even if it's cheaper than $600 to buy from, you know, the various companies who supply RAM for Apple's machines, on the retail market, like OWC, for instance, TransIntel is a company I've bought a lot from. There's several great RAM dealers out there. I bet you, though, that you're going to end up, see, 2 4 gigs, looks like there's 4 slots. You'd end up having to ditch the 8 gigs that it came with.
Yes, of course.
If you were to do 32 gigs on your own.
Yeah, I'm sure that's exactly what would happen.
Yeah. And that's too bad. But whatever.
But hey, that means you can go up to 64 gigs of RAM in that machine.
I don't know. Can you?
Isn't it 4 slots?
Well, it's 4 slots. Apple's only offering 4 8-gig modules for 32 gigs. It seems like they would have a 64 gig option if it supported it.
No, they've done this before.
Well, yeah, but maybe the RAM they're using doesn't do it.
Right, so therefore they won't say 64 gig, but third-party RAM that does do it will still work.
Right.
I bet. Okay, listeners, more homework for you. Someone pop 64 gigs of RAM into their brand new 5K iMac and let us know what happens.
Alternately, you can send me one, and I'll do it. I'm putting myself out there.
You know, that is so generous of you.
It is very generous of me. So these new models, they've got some nice new processors. These 5K displays have been met with delight by people who have had them for the last year.
Mm-hmm.
They look good, but here's my question.
Okay.
Where is an updated Mac Pro?
That's a really good question. We're coming up on 2.5 years with no update at all for the Mac Pro.
These things were announced in June of 2013. 2.33 years ago.
2.33 years ago.
That's a nod to John Martellaro, who's going to be putting together some thoughts on this, but I'm tense about it. Where is an updated Mac Pro? And Apple built a factory to make these things. Apple designed machinery, designed manufacturing process, built and developed their own manufacturing processes for some of this stuff. And we go 2.5 years without an update. I'm sorry, 2.33 years without an update. And, you know, of course, the things didn't really ship until the spring of 2014.
Mm-hmm.
There were some that were out there, but by and large, they didn't ship until the spring of 2014.
Can you imagine how bored the people are working in that factory? They've been putting together the same thing for 2.33 years.
Yeah, it's probably not going to. I don't understand why Apple would make the investment. Okay, Mac Pro probably doesn't sell in huge numbers,
which made it a good choice for Apple's first in-country computer manufacturing facility.
In years.
Yes, yes.
But, I mean, why bother making that investment if they're then going to let it languish? It doesn't make any sense to me.
No, I don't get that.
And especially for a device aimed at computationally intensive uses. So both from a creative a professional standpoint and from a scientific standpoint. I know that's John Martellaro's personal and specific interest.
Mm-hmm.
You're talking about a machine that is a lot of money because it's being aimed at people who want the processing power, and then you continue to ship the same 2-year-old processor in it. That doesn't make any sense.
No, it doesn't. And the price that you're paying for that computer today is the same price that you would have paid 2.33 years ago.
Yeah. It's not like the price has come down. Yet you know that the price on the CPUs has actually come down, because that's the way Intel works.
Right. And there are products from other companies. Actually, John Martellar and I talked about this a little bit this morning on Daily Observations. And we were both commenting on how Hewlett-Packard's Z series workstations can dance circles around the Mac Pro based on their specs. And they're using current stuff in their machines as opposed to 2-year-old components that we have in the Mac Pro.
Yeah. You know, the Mac Pro is this beautiful piece of machinery. That the beauty actually comes with significant drawbacks to specifically, you know, you can get like 1 terabyte of 1 terabyte of storage for a Pro machine is ridiculous. It's ridiculous. It's just absolutely ridiculous is what it is.
Yes, but Apple's stance is, look, you have these Thunderbolt ports. You can plug in some crazy fast external storage right there, kids.
Yeah, you can. It's ridiculous. It's ridiculous. And not to mention the fact that the only display you can get from Apple on this this thing is the, what is it, 7-year-old? 5-year-old?
Yeah, something like that. It's many years old, and it's $1,000, as I recall. A 27-inch display, and I have a 34-inch display on my desk right now.
From
Hewlett-Packard. It's the Envy 34C. So it's a 34-inch curved display,
and it's gorgeous.
And it costs $1,000. And it supports HDMI. It has 2 HDMI ports on it. It does mini display port and has the USB hub built into it and all that stuff. Stereo speakers built in, and it's $1,000.
Well, you don't have the option of adding even the Thunderbolt 2 display in the buy in the store part of the configuration part of the Mac Pro.
Are you serious?
Yeah, choose processor, choose memory, choose storage, graphics, choose mouse or trackpad, Apple keyboard. Done. I wonder, is Apple even still?
Yeah, their display's still there. At least it was.
Well, where do you find it on this crazy new store?
I think it shows up under accessories.
Oh, accessories. Yeah, there we go. All right, accessories. There we go. Yeah, $9.99. Thing is still $9.99. 27-inch display. I mean, and it's a good-looking 27-inch display, but it's no 5K display. It's no 4K display, which you can get on the iMac. I mean, what Apple needs to get its act together on this. This is actually, there's this disconnect here. The best display that Apple offers should not be on its consumer device exclusively. I mean, it's impressive what Apple has done. The 5K display on the iMac is impressive. It's incredible. But the fact that you cannot get from Apple a display like that to work with your 2-year-old Mac Pro is ridiculous.
Yeah. If I were in the market to buy a brand new display today, it wouldn't even cross my mind to go to Apple for
it. No. $9.99? Are you kidding? How much is that 34-inch? That thing, by the way, that thing is gorgeous. How much is it?
It's $9.99.
Same price.
Yeah, so same price as Apple's display, and yet it does so much more, and it's 34 inches instead of 27 inches. When I look at what I could spend that $1,000 on, I cannot justify on any level buying Apple's display.
No, and there are 5K displays from HP too.
Yes.
What are they priced at?
Oh, off the top of my head, I don't know, but I know that you can get a beautiful 4K display from them for like $650.
Here is
it might actually be a little bit less than that. But
Z display, 5K display, $19.99. More than an iMac.
Okay, more than an iMac. But you can get a 27-inch 4K display for like $650.
I'm looking at another one here. Oh, here's the 5K one for $12.19.
Okay.
That's white. That's from Tiger Direct. Ultra high definition Z, Def Z. So they have three different models, 4K and 5K, that are on the market right now. $699. What? How much? Well, this is 3840 by 2160.
That's nice.
What? Yeah, but what is that? 5K? Is that 4K?
No, this is. That's 4K. Gonna be about 4K.
It's a 4K one for $699. Here is a 4K one for $549.
Yeah.
I would not buy Apple's display. Now, I've got a. I think it was still called the Cinema Display. It's the.
Uh-huh.
It's the one that was right before the Thunderbolt Display. Was it?
Yeah, that was still called the Cinema Display.
Yeah, I've got one. It's gorgeous and everything, but I wouldn't. I mean, it'd be crazy. Why would you spend $1,000 on an Apple Display?
I couldn't justify it.
No, doesn't make any sense.
That same money gets me a 34-inch curved display that supports picture-in-picture. So I could plug like an Apple TV into an HDMI port on this,
mm-hmm,
and watch Apple TV stuff while I'm driving my computer with this and working on stuff.
With plenty of room left over.
It has a thing that I haven't even bothered to figure out yet called Mobility Connect. So it can connect directly to your mobile devices. And, the built-in stereo speakers, all that stuff. And what I'm saying is, I have a display on my desk right now that has more features than I can use.
Yeah. Yeah. And me, who has been on a Pro device, a Mac Pro, since the 90s, right?
Mm-hmm.
There's no way I would buy a Mac Pro today. I'd have to buy an iMac. The 5K iMac would be it right now. If I bought a new Mac right this, like we finished recording this podcast, and I click bounce and it's bouncing down, and I'm going to go order a new Mac, it would be an iMac 5K. It would not be a Mac Pro.
Yeah, if I were in the market to buy a desktop Mac, I would be buying a 5K iMac. I wouldn't even hesitate.
What's extra ridiculous is that the Mac Pro from 2 years ago is designed to support 5K displays.
Mm-hmm.
And yet, it doesn't make any sense. They have to get their act together on this.
You know how you talk about how when something seems completely irrational,
yes,
there's a key piece of information we're missing?
Yes.
I have to believe that there's a key piece of information we're missing here. Because happening with Apple's Pro hardware line just simply doesn't make sense to me.
And when Apple finally announced the Mac Pro in June of 2013, it was like, okay, this is what we've been waiting for all this time. Okay, I agree.
Right.
Because it had been years since there had been an update to the old Mac Pro.
And then we assumed that 12 months later, we'd get the updated model.
Yeah.
And that 12 months after that, we get the updated model.
Yeah.
And here we are.
Here we are. Nothing. There's a rumor that it's going to be updated in 2016 sometime.
Yeah.
It's ridiculous. And it doesn't make any sense to me. It's crazy. All right. We are so far. What are we? We are counting the bumpers. We're at an hour and 8 minutes.
Yeah.
Sorry, guys.
But, you know, when Brian gets on a rant, what you going to do?
What are you going to do?
Oh, I know what I could do. And that's this week's Apple Context Machine. If you have anything to comment on, add, or question, write us at acm@macobserver.com. And hey, thanks for listening.
Our content is written by the good people at the Mac Observer, rants included. Our bandwidth is provided by Cashfly, the basis by Boom, recorded just for TMO. And that's all for this week.
And hey, stay subscribed.
We'll see you online at the Mac Observer.
This display is so big.